Simple Beep, episode 68, Haxies. Hello, and welcome to Simple Beep, a podcast looking back at the history of Apple and the Mac community. I'm Ed Cormony.
And I'm Brian Sartorius.
And on today's show, we're going to finally get to one of the topics that I think has been kicking around in our topic list maybe since the beginning of the show. It's been in there for a while that we've wanted to do this. And it's an interesting topic because it kind of gets at the painful transition between the classic Mac and OS X. And we'll get to that in a moment, but first we have some follow-up. Speaking about things that go back to the beginning of the show, this past month, I had a little interview piece in the 512 Pixels newsletter. This is from friend of the show, Stephen Hackett's website, 512 Pixels. He also has a monthly subscription, and you can get a newsletter that goes along with that. You pay, very fittingly, the price of $5.12 per month. And I have a little interview in there, and he asks some questions about how this show got started. So if you want some additional behind the scenes, I would suggest going supporting Stephen, because we like a lot of the stuff that he does. And you'll also be able to check that out. It's one of those things where if you sign up now, you get all the back issues. So if you haven't checked it out before, it's probably worth your while.
Another piece of follow-up from an episode a while back about Apple museums, our episode number 59. One of the museums that I don't know if we directly covered in that episode, the Apple Museum in Poland, recently came into possession of a Basis 108 machine, 108. And this is cool in many ways, but I think most notably because it is an Apple II clone. We've talked a lot about clones on this show, but we're always talking about the Macintosh OS clones of the mid to late 1990s. And this was really cool to see that cloning Apple computers went all the way back to the Apple II as well.
Yeah, it's interesting that there was that time period there where that could actually happen. It makes sense that, if you go back to something like the Apple I, it was such a homebrew type of kit that there wasn't really much secret to it. You just needed to have the right chips in the right place. So it was interesting that people were trying to do that with the Apple II. And I think that this one, they said that it had some interesting features. Like it had like a super heavy duty case, and maybe not some of the design features that you would expect from the first party Apple II. And I think the disk drives were one of the things that was very hard to change. I think if you look at the pictures, it's just got the regular Apple disk drives mounted right in the case because they had to buy those off the shelf and couldn't recreate them.
I was going to mention that as well. In these photos of the Basis 108, you see the caption saying like, this is an Apple II clone, but you look at it and say, there are a couple six color Apple logos plastered right on it. How could this be a clone? And yet it's because these are logos on the disk drive. And I think one is on the keyboard as well.
Yeah, it's interesting the lengths that people would go to get an Apple II. And of course, at various points in history, people have been motivated to make clones for the simple reason that like when it's early in a company or a product's existence, sometimes they aren't distributed there and you have to make your own to even get it in that part of the world.
Yeah, I think it might actually be right on the money because I was looking for information about the Basis 108, and there is a Wikipedia article about that model of computer, but there is no English translation of it. I think the master entry was written in German. So maybe that's where this machine came from.
So now on to our topic for this episode. And like I said, this is something that I think really gets to the heart of the OS 9 to OS 10 transition. And so we left it out in some of our earliest episodes because we were trying to focus mostly on the classic Mac, pre-OS 10. But now we've got to the point where we have plenty of hindsight for the OS 10 era itself. And we've talked in sort of abstract terms about what that meant for Apple products, for marketing, and for Apple users as they made their way through this transition. But one of the things that you may get the impression of when you're listening to current Apple news is like, people are upset that Apple have changed things. And, or like, people are upset that a feature is missing from an Apple product. And that definitely happened around that time where there was just a huge change in how you were expected to use a Mac, even though it was still a Mac. And you would think that this would be sort of a community aspect or something that would just be like I said, we've talked about it in generalities, just sort of a general undercurrent of what was going on in 2001 as people were starting to pick up OS X and use apps in Classic and try to move over and get their work done totally in the OS X environment. But the interesting thing about this story is that it really gets wrapped up a lot in just a single company, like a single, almost like an indie developer, a very small software company. And that company is called, or was called, Unsanity. Their tagline was "Unsane tools for insane people." So they were a little bit quirky. And later they changed that to "for insanely great people," with, of course, the reference to, you know, Steve Jobs quotes and Apple lore. So this company came up with some of the very first hacks for OS X. And their goals with these hacks really transformed over time, but it was a lot about what people wanted to do with their Macs that they just weren't able to do before. And that's what Unsanity was most famous for, but they did exist in the OS 9 era, well, you know, pre-OS 10 era, and had some products that maybe you remember from then.
We'll put a link in the show notes to one of the co-founders of Unsanity, Slava Karpenko. He joined a development, he's still developing for Apple products, I think more iOS than Mac these days, and he joined the development shop WildBit in the year 2015, and they wrote a blog post introducing him to the world as one of their new employees, and in it, he talks about how, you know, he was a developer, he was kind of raised in developing on the Mac Plus and HyperCard, a story that a lot of us share. And then he was on IRC in the late 1990s and met Dmitry Boldriev, who was working on Mac Amp, the Mac port of Winamp, an MP3 player.
And pretty much the first MP3 player for the Mac, as I recall.
And it sounds like right around the time that Mac Amp 1.0 was released, Dmitry could no longer work on it. So he kind of handed that over back to Slava. And Slava, in his words, said, "This begins the era where I was stuck making various MP3 audio players that lasted from 1998 to 2002. Mac Amp, Mac Ast, Mac Amp Lite, and then two programs that were released under the Unsanity corporate umbrella, Echo and Mint Audio. Echo, I had no recollection of this program, but looking at its pages on Unsanity's Wayback Machine, it seems to be a little bit in the Audion camp of like lots of support for different file formats, playlist support that kind of mirrors your Finder folder structure, and visualizers and skins."
Yeah, I definitely remember the Unsanity Echo name, and I remember this sort of default look that you can see in some of the screenshots that are preserved in the Wayback Machine archive of the Unsanity website, where there's sort of this default view that is like a blue oval. And I would say that it was probably, you know, like the third running Mac MP3 player at that time, where you had Audion, you had SoundJam, which were sort of like big indie and more commercial. And then Unsanity was the little indie guy who wound up being an also ran, not because it lost out in the, you know, iTunes versus the rest war, but more because Unsanity actually moved on to this other area. One thing you said, that it had lots of different file format support in Unsanity, and there's one line on their product description of it that I find, you know, just delightful in hindsight, which is that it, quote, supports the much anticipated Ogg Vorbis format.
And then Mint Audio, I think the last MP3 related software program that Slava/Unsanity released, was to me very reminiscent of Mac Amp Lite, or Malt, as users from the late 1990s might remember it, in that they were both minimized MP3 players that maybe on the back end for playlist control and different plugins and file format support, the same as the fuller featured Echo and Audion and SoundJam. But it was basically just their player window and any skins that might alter its appearance were kind of the size and shape of a control strip. And in remembering all of this and finding out that Slava worked on all of these programs, I wondered if there's a story maybe dealing with the IP in the MacAmp/WinAmp/MacAst naming rights that would explain why he worked on the kind of first party named MP3 playing apps and then made versions that at least looked similar from these Internet Archive pages, if not actually were similar, released by his own company under different names. There might be a kind of interesting counterpoint to Panic's Audion story going on here that I wasn't able to find out anymore, but maybe someone out there knows.
Yeah, it's definitely all of a piece in this era. These two products actually spanned the pre-iTunes and post-iTunes era. And I was going kind of very meticulously through Wayback pages where you can page capture by capture if you have the patience for it. And noticed that because I wanted to see how Unsanity was adding products one at a time. And I noticed that at some point after iTunes started to take off, the pricing, because these were like shareware apps, the pricing for Echo especially dropped significantly. It was like, it used to be like a $20 app and they're like $7, I don't know, $5, anything you'll give me for it, because you all have iTunes now.
Yeah, can't compete with free and first party.
I think that was also part of the reason for Mint's existence, was that it was trying to do something different than iTunes. It was deliberately minimalist, where everyone went, okay, I get it. Like, Apple now has a first party solution for the full on music library approach to playing music, but not everybody needed that or wanted that. So it was a good try, but I think that everyone, as we now know, and as we've seen things transition through the iPod era, the iTunes era, and into the streaming era, that people really do want, if not all of the world's songs, they want a big library.
But we're not here on this episode to talk about Unsanity's audio playing programs. We're here to talk about their wide variety of things masquerading as programs, but are really hacks to your system to make it, like Ed said, function and in some cases appear differently.
Yeah, I think the charitable term that you could use for these would be utilities, right? I mean, they are all single purpose utilities, but the thing that made them famous and infamous and unified the way that they worked is how they got their hooks into the system in the early OS X days. And part of the thing that was the transition here was the fact that people coming from Mac OS 8 or Mac OS 9 were used to installing lots and lots of extensions and dealing with all of the fallout that came with that. But that was just part of owning, maintaining, and using a Mac. If you wanted your Mac to be most useful, you were going to have dozens of extensions, and you tried to make it not hundreds of extensions, and you tried to figure out which ones were actually compatible with each other and eliminate ones that were superfluous to you, because otherwise you were going to have a really crashy, sad system. But there were so many things that where extensions were just required and really, opened up lots of great functionality, like thinking about extensions that I ran, like the Kaleidoscope extension that allowed you to actually double click a Kaleidoscope scheme and then the whole, every piece of UI on the screen would change. Obviously, that was like going in and doing a lot with, the window manager as it was.
Yeah.
And just, like how everything was being drawn on screen was just being dynamically, and unsafely changed on the fly by those extensions. And then when Apple announced OS X, you know, sort of showed their intentions of how they were bringing a Next-like Unix-based system over, people said, well, what's the equivalent of extensions going to be? How are we going to do all of these wonderful things that we used to do on our Macs exclusively through enabled through extensions? And the straightforward answer was, well, OS X has no extensions. And the less straightforward answer was, psst, hey, have you heard of kernel extensions? It's got extension right in the name. but it was not the kind of thing that was supposed to be really even accessible if used by a typical user, as opposed to the classic model where, you know, you got to the point in, what was it, system 7.5, where you could drag an extension onto the system folder and it would say, hey, this is an extension. Would you like to enable it? It was a very different model, even if the system was extensible. So these little apps were considered hacks, and this is how they got their name. So from marketing copy on the Unsanity site, they said that we call them hacksies. So mix hack with the X from Mac OS X and you'll get hacksy. Interestingly, though, you know, they got a reputation from the same marketing copy. Mac OS X may be great, fast, stable, and useful, but sometimes you surely will need a feature or two added. And, well, I suppose that means that you are more concerned with useful because you may be sacrificing great, fast, and stable by installing a hacksy.
Yes.
We'll get to that a little bit. But this name stuck. I mean, it's a cute, clever name. I didn't even really quite recognize the etymology of it, even though they put it right there on their website. People just came to know that these little system hacks that worked differently than they used to in the classic Mac, but did cool things on OS X, were called hacksies. And interestingly, later in Unsanity's existence, they got defensive about this. And so, like, in the footer of their website, it started saying things like, the term hacksy is a trademark of Unsanity LLC, even though they, like, never registered it, at least not in the United States, even though they were based in the US. And, like, they were very sort of faux litigious about this, where they wanted to keep other people off of the hacksy name, even though at that point it had gotten a pretty bad name, which is really interesting. But like I said, this concept and this company were really wrapped up in one.
So talking about some of these first Unsanity hacksies, like Ed said, this happened around the transition from the classic Mac OS to Mac OS X. And you can see that in a lot of their first initial run of hacksies were basically to make elements of Mac OS X look and or feel like the classic Mac OS we were leaving behind. And perhaps the most notable of all of these was a hacksie called Window Shade 10, where 10 is represented as the letter X. One reason this is notable is that it was shareware. Shareware also kind of seems now like one of the relics from the classic Mac OS, as opposed to these kind of freemium try before you buy software that is a whole other discussion whenever we tackle the Mac App Store. But yeah, it was $7 shareware, and like its name suggests, it aimed to restore the window shade, like title bar collapsing that was introduced in Mac OS 8 and then removed in OS 10 in favor of the much demoed graphics card taxing genie effect, minimizing a window as it slurps down into a spot in the dock.
So one of the interesting things about this is, and I find it a little bit ironic, is just the way that Window Shade 10 came around, is that the original Window Shade was a classic Mac extension, and I believe it was either freeware or shareware. And it was completely unaffiliated with the people at Unsanity. It was a different person who wrote Window Shade. It became extremely popular. And then in the transition from System 7 to OS 8, it got turned into a first-party feature where, and I think that was actually bought out by Apple, not just purely Sherlocked. I think they actually bought the code from Window Shade. And in System 7 to to roll up the shade of a window, you would double click on the title bar and the window would collapse to just the title bar. And then in OS 8, the actual minimize window shade widget was added as the third control on pretty much every window in the system. Then in OS 10, you preserved the three controls, moved them all over to the one side, made them a stoplight, which irked a lot of people. And then the behavior of the minimization was changed. But it was kind of funny, though, that I think that it started off as like a third-party extension that totally changes the behavior of Windows. And then Apple said that was a great idea. And then they changed it to something else. And people said, wait, no, we want that third-party way of changing the behavior of our Windows. And so there was still a market for it, even after it had gone through the whole sort of Sherlocking, and I say that in anachronistic scare quotes there, because this was long before the actual Sherlocking first happened, because that was Sherlock 3, which happened later in the OS X era.
Another early Unsanity hexy was called Shadow Killer, and this was to get rid of the, again, graphics card taxing drop shadows for every window in OS X. And I forgot to go through John Siracusa's many detailed reviews of OS X, because I think he covered how the depth, or just really how absurd the drop shadows were from each major release of OS X, because I think it's changed, like maybe the opacity or like the radius and how far the shadow reaches.
Yeah, they've gotten bigger and smaller, and they got toned down at one point. The time that you really notice that I almost don't notice that they're there anymore. Until like iTunes freaks out or something. And I had this happen, I don't know, maybe it was a couple iTunes versions ago. iTunes will freak out and generate like 50 versions of the same dialog box on top of each other in exactly the same place. And then it's just surrounded by black because all of the shadows have stacked up. Mm-hmm. But it was something that was, my gosh, people would have killed for drop shadows in the classic Mac. I mean, there were kaleidoscope schemes in the Kaleidoscope 2 era where people made fake drop shadows on the windows by doing dithering patterns of the window mask, because you only had a one-bit mask. People wanted this so badly. And then finally, a real, true, smooth, properly composited drop shadow is on every window in OS X. And suddenly people hated it and said, get these off my windows.
At least later on in OS X, there was one of those kind of hidden system preferences where you go into the terminal and swap a Boolean from yes to no. But this hidden system preference would only affect window shadows when captured in screenshots, not actually in your live usage of the system. So Shadow Killer may have looked like it would be Sherlocked by this little system preference, but it actually would be removing the shadows as you use the computer.
Quickly, on the heels of these first two products that sort of got a name for Unsanity and their hacksies early on, they started putting out other hacksy products. And like I said, these were all released as individual utilities that you could download and install separately, or you could install them all and crash your system immediately. The next two that they released were also really like callbacks to the way that the classic macOS behaved. The first of these is called Fruit Menu, which makes me think of like some sort of off-brand product or like the iFruit in Foxtrot. But it was called Fruit Menu, and this was a reaction to the fact that in OS X, the Apple menu did not behave the way that it used to, where it used to be about this Mac and then just a open world for customization. Throw an alias to your hard drive in the Apple menu items folder and go crazy with your mouse trying to navigate your entire hard drive structure without accidentally undoing one of the menus and having to start over. But people really loved having that quick access and customizability in the Apple menu and weren't finding any of the solutions that were present in early OS X up to the challenge. Like, for example, now you could kind of recreate that, I suppose, with like a folder in the dock and have a stack or a grid view pop out from a custom folder that either had the actual items in it or aliases in them. But that wasn't until, I want to say like 10.6 or something that those features were added to the dock. So this really was kind of missing. I mean, your other option was just to, like throw everything on the desktop or something. So people wanted this this quick launching functionality of the Apple Menu back, and this is precisely what Fruit Menu did. I can't tell from the screenshots because they're very close cropped, and I have not been able to. I'm not even going to try to run a Haxi in an emulator or like a virtual machine. It's just too much. I can't remember if it actually replaced the Apple Menu or sat alongside the Apple Menu. And I know that this is another one of those areas where Unsanity and their branding was a little bit interesting. They always kind of came close to some Apple brands and stuff, and Fruit Menu was one of those. I mean, obviously they didn't call it like new Apple Menu or something because they knew that they would get a letter immediately. But in various iterations, it either had the Unsanity logo, which was nothing like the Apple Menu or the Apple logo. But then some later versions of it got a little bit bolder and had basically the Apple logo, but with the bite put back in. As you know, it's like it's a whole apple. You can't stop us from drawing pictures of apples, can you? Well, yes, depending.
Yeah, towing the line for sure.
The next one added back some classic macOS functionality that I don't know. I sure didn't miss. I didn't remember that it existed. This little Haxi was called, I'm going to guess here, Zounds. Gadzooks. it's spelled X-O-U-N-D-S. And what this did was, I forgot this feature existed, but it added back the appearance sounds that were a feature that I think came in maybe macOS 8.5 or macOS 9. So in the appearance manager control panel, there was a separate tab called sounds, and you could turn on these various interface sounds. And there were things like little clicks and pops every time that you would drag through a menu. There were other drag actions, like if you are dragging a window around the screen, or even resizing it would make a separate type of sound. And I don't know if we're going to publish this episode in stereo or not, but if we do, or if you go back and play with these, the drag sounds would actually pan from left to right if you dragged an icon across, back and forth across the screen, and then there was a separate sound when you finally dropped it in a folder. If you turned all of these on, it was just like, it was like you had turned your Mac into a bop it or something. Like just click, whir, buzz, bop, pow. And it was it's too much, I think. But apparently some people really liked these. And I guess in the early versions of OS X, 10.0, 10.1, there were none of these interface sounds. Since then, Apple has actually added back some interface sounds, which are enabled by default in OS X, which blows my mind when I'm near somebody who has those interface sounds still on and the speakers on, and they empty the trash and there's a crinkling paper noise, or they drop something in a folder and it sounds like they've just like let go of a spring. I mean, it's a weird little piece of the Mac interface in general that I thought was fairly well left behind with the OS X transition, but has actually sort of made its way back. But for those who are really pining for their interface sounds, this Haxi did it for them. And of course, if you're thinking now about how that Haxi must have worked, where, you know, with like Fruit Menu, okay, you have to put a menu up in the menu bar. That's not so ridiculous. I mean, especially now, we have all kinds of menu bar apps that live on the right-hand side of our screen. I mean, most of us need Bartender to keep them all in control, and it's an officially supported part of the system to extend it in that way by having additional menus that give you useful features that Apple doesn't provide with the system, but you want to have access to from within any application. Zounds, on the other hand, though, it had to be monitoring for all of these events, like, you know, like rolling over each individual selectable menu item in a drop-down menu, regardless of whether it was in the top menu bar or in a pop-up menu, and just like polling for those system events and then being able to act on them is, you know, pretty intensive and not really, you know, not really something that OS X was meant to handle. You know, they claimed that you could get performance gains by turning on something like Shadow Killer because of, like you said, Brian, GPU issues, or CPU if you didn't have a GPU that was actually doing the work for you. But something like this is going in the opposite direction and like maybe pegging your CPU even when you don't need it. And like, who knows, was it like really well optimized, or if you turned off the menu sounds, was it still like pulling every menu action? These were the kinds of things that would add up if you added a lot of hacksies to your system.
Mm-hmm.
One other early one in here that I think also speaks to just like the reactive, conservative nature of the things that drove the design decisions for hacksies is one that's called Dock Detox. And I think this was their first Jaguar hacksie, because I forgot this, but apparently in 10.2, they changed the appearance of the dock. And some people had grown used to the appearance of the dock in 10.0 and 10.1 and despised the new dock and wanted to make it look like the old one. So it would do that, and it also would get rid of dock bouncing, which some people thought was highly annoying. I have to imagine that the number of people who were running Zounds and Dock Detox simultaneously were not very many, because if you liked those sounds, I'm sure that the bouncing would be right up your alley.
And to be clear, it's not just the dock bouncing as an application boots, but also if an application wants your attention, like a notification happens, like you receive an IM and ADM, the little duck would bounce. This would turn off all the bouncing. All right, so that covers a bunch of kind of standalone little utility hacksies.
At this point, the products page on Unsanity was getting pretty crowded.
And you know, you may have your opinions about certainly how useful these are, but I think it's impossible to deny that they were popular. They found their audience. So in the middle of 2002, Unsanity released a platform and an SDK for creating these system-level modifications, these hacksies, called Application Enhancer, or APE.
And I think it must have been pronounced ape, because all the icons are apes.
That makes some of the that makes this section a little funnier. One thing about ape is that it was not just a platform for Unsanity's hacksies, but it was a platform that, you know, any developer could download and use to create their system level modifications. The pricing for APE kind of rose as you could afford it, basically, for kind of the hobbyist, independent, single developer, or just a user who wanted to have the entire platform running on their machine. It was completely free. If you were a company looking to release a shareware hacksie, Unsanity would charge $100 per hacksie that you released that was built on APE. If you were a big time commercial company, Unsanity would charge you $1,000 per hacksie. And there's even a line in here that said shareware generating more than $10,000 of revenue per year is going to be considered commercial.
We'll see in a little bit. They got that fee at least once.
This is setting up at least one very big brand.
Also, I think I was talking earlier, and maybe we got this a little bit out of order, but like, this is one of the reasons I found it so funny that later on, as hacksies were on the wane, they were so defensive that hacksie is our term, when one of the things that made them, you know, exploded them to the height of their popularity was when they said, we're making this a platform and anyone can build a hacksie. They're all called hacksies.
I'm not sure, you know, all the business decisions that went on here, but it's clear that it did become big business. And when you're dealing with a platform that is tinkering with like the very like close to the metal parts of your operating system, things are liable to go wrong. Certainly a very amateur developer who just wants to kind of make their own personal maybe theme for OS X might do something sloppily or, you know, like not clean up memory or something and crash their system. But what came to happen is that the entire Ape platform would need to be meticulously updated for every update to the Mac OS because it was running, like Ed was saying, like polling for, you know, pixel by pixel changes to where your cursor is on a menu. You know, if a single line item of code in the OS changes, that could throw off the entire platform. And there are very many reasons to believe that this is something that actually happened.
Right. And, you know, if you want to think about this, this platform was almost like jailbreaking your Mac in some respect, you know, not in the sense that it was prohibited by any like software license or any of the actual, you know, security controls of the system. It was all open, you know, macOS 10.0 slash system. I mean, sure, you can go in there if you want. You're just going to like, there's nothing you can do in there that will be productive unless you're, you know, unless you're really super clever, like Unsanity. But even then, you know, make one wrong turn and the whole system is coming crashing down. And Haxies and Ape got a reputation for that to the point that they were trying to disclaim this on their website. They said, application enhancers cannot affect the core system, despite the fact that they're installed in slash system. We'll get to that in a second.
Oh, yeah.
They operate on an application level. Therefore, they cannot cause a whole macOS 10 system to crash. Well, no, they operate on an application level. But, you know, as we know, the OS 10 model is the Unix-based model, which is a process model. And they weren't really operating on the application level. It's not just like, oh, well, this is going to, you know, this is going to crash Safari and then whatever, I'll relaunch Safari. It's like, this is going to crash, you know, Windows Server, or this is going to crash Core Audio D, or this is going to crash some process that it's trying to muck around in its memory. And yeah, it's not going to cause a kernel panic because it's not actually a kernel extension, but it can cause damage that, you know, or crashes that to the user seemed just as severe, or in some cases, actually more severe.
So it all kind of came crashing down for Ape with the release of macOS 10.5 Leopard. There were many, many user reports of a specific pattern of system crashes, which is after installing Leopard, when your system would reboot, you would get a blue screen. This is what a lot of the reports say. And because it's happening during the boot process, there aren't really good screenshots. I think we've covered this a couple times on the show that you go looking for this and you find people who have, with a digital camera, taken photos of their screen. And it's even hard to find some of these, but it's not the Windows blue screen of death where there's that kind of old DOS system font, you know, spitting out an error code. This is basically your system would go through the gray screen with the Apple, and then under a good Leopard install, move to the kind of aqua blue screen and then render like the little dialog box with a progress bar on it that said starting up, you know, maybe some other things about that. What in the classic macOS would say, like your extensions were loading and the little icons would go across the screen. What it sounds like is that if you had a mildly old version of the Ape platform installed in your system before you upgraded to Leopard, your Mac on the restart from the install would get to just this blue screen after the gray screen with the Apple and hang. And that sucks.
That particular blue, it's interesting that it carried over into Leopard because Leopard was the first of the big cats in space that had the sort of, you know, like wispy star matter nebula desktop background, and all of the versions before that had these aqua blue, swirly, swoopy backgrounds. And that blue that you saw in boot was, it was like just like the average blue. It was like if you took those desktops and just like ran a 20,000 pixel blur over them and just calculated the average blue, because that could be drawn really fast before the system actually went and loaded in the image. And so it was still using that routine in Leopard, and whatever was going on before that, the operating system was ready to draw your desktop background. Ape got in the way somehow.
And so eventually, Ape was figured out to be the culprit, and the fallout was bad. This is kind of what this episode has been building towards. Haxies and Haxies built slash distributed on Ape became known as the things that would completely wreck your system. There is an email from the Apple Developer Technical Support email list that is still on apple.com, lists.apple.com to be specific. We'll put a link in the show notes, where one of their developer technical support representatives, George Warner, speaks on behalf of Apple in response to an email titled "Distributed Object and Run Loops I Didn't Start." This developer writes in and says, "This has been running fine until user X shows up. User X has Unsanity's Ape installed. When they run my application, UI element application hangs."
Right. See, this is why I was saying, oh, yeah, we can't crash anything more than an application. No, we can crash anything that has a UI element in it.
And George's response to this developer begins, "Our," in parentheses, "Apple's official policy is that we don't support aped systems." That's APE apostrophe D systems, period. "The data miner that parses all the crash logs that are sent to us automatically ignores any report that has ape APIs in the backtraces or DYLB lists." So like if you're a user and you've done this to your system, we know that that's the fault and we're not going to help you. Like, fix that first.
You know how the default response from Apple and in the community now is, if you have a crash, file a radar. They're basically saying, don't file a radar. In fact, we're literally ignoring all of this. This is like the software equivalent of voiding your warranty.
That's a great way to put it. We've been talking about Unsanity's product page for their various Haxies and at various states of capture on the Internet Archive. And there is a great page that's kind of a subpage of the Ape SDK area of Unsanity's website. And there's a capture that is clearly from the time after OS X Leopard was released, which is a grid of all of Unsanity's products and which version of macOS X they're compatible with. And the column for Leopard on this page, it was captured in October 2007, has one green dot for the Haxi chat transcript manager, and every other dot is red for Leopard. None of these Unsanity products, Haxi or Ape or otherwise, were compatible with Leopard.
The other thing about this, though, is that we said that the particularly nasty bug where, like, your whole system wouldn't start up after you installed an operating system update was really only if you had a slightly out-of-date version of Ape running on your system. And you would think that the type of people who were keen on installing Haxies would be the kind of people who would be always looking for updates, always looking for new things, always keeping their software on the latest and greatest, and this wouldn't affect them. So how did so many people wind up having out-of-date Ape on their systems? Well, maybe if they didn't know that it was there in the first place.
That's right. We talked about how the Ape SDK was able to be licensed out to, as Unsanity put it, commercial partners, people who make over $10,000 a year in revenue. Well, one of those partners was Logitech, maker of mice, keyboards, and other input devices that often needed their own custom drivers to take full advantage of the hardware in macOS X. And at some point during the the run of the Ape SDK, Logitech's control center drivers either bundled or built part of the driver on the Ape SDK. So if you bought a certain vintage Logitech mouse or Logitech keyboard or other input device and were using the software that came with it, as you would be expected to do, you surreptitiously installed whatever version came with that input device of the Ape SDK on your system and did not know it because it wasn't called that. It was under the guise of your Logitech drivers.
Logitech makes great mice and have been known for developing the absolute worst software for OS X using the worst possible practices. And I would know because I have some of their products. I don't think that I ever had one in this era when they were aping people's systems. We'll link to a great article on Daring Fireball from when this was discovered, including, I mean, John Gruber can take him down far better than I can, but he goes off on Logitech, quote, "It's utterly absurd and completely irresponsible for Logitech to base their mouse software on a completely and utterly unsupported by Apple system software modification." And yeah, they got called out for that. And so what did they decide to do by the time that I bought a Logitech mouse? How about they wrote their own kernel extension that led to kernel panics every day until you uninstalled it and used it as a dumb, ordinary USB or Bluetooth mouse.
Ugh.
The one useful thing that came out of this Logitech debacle is that Apple, up until now, their position was just like, we ain't touching that. You did a dumb thing. Don't come to us. But when they realized that this was being propagated by a company that they didn't want to piss off, that was, like I said, they make good hardware and have partnered with Apple in the past, and Apple may even still sell some of their products. Who knows? So they actually gave instructions on how to fix this situation. If you got into this blue screen situation, your only recourse was basically to boot into single user mode, which gives you a terminal prompt, and then go in there and literally just excise the portions of the system that had been modified by Ape. And they initially said to remove 4 files. And interestingly, 3 of these were in slash library and one of them was in slash system. And then they modified the instructions. They realized you only had to get rid of, you only had to rm-rf in single user mode. Don't type it wrong. Slash system slash library slash system configuration slash application enhancer dot bundle. And this is the thing. It's like, what is in there? Nobody knows. Like, it's not an app, but it's effectively an app. Like, at this point in OS X, dot app and dot bundle were, they're the same thing. It's just a question of how the system is going to treat them. And the fact that Ape had put this in here meant that this code, this application code, was running at boot, which was not a good idea.
Explains why the crash happened where it did.
Right. And then one of the other things that they suggested to remove that wound up not to be critical was the application enhancer framework. And you said, like, calling private APIs. This is the difference. Like, I think that people don't necessarily understand what the issue is with calling private APIs in iOS or in macOS now. It's not like calling private APIs is an inherently dangerous thing to do in a particular version of the operating system. And the APIs, at least some of them, aren't private because Apple is being mean and not sharing them with developers. I mean, some of them are for security reasons, like, you know, some API that modifies data in your iCloud account or something is private for security reasons. But some of them are private just because Apple knows how the operating system works and you don't. And they know how co-involved and convoluted that particular API is with the rest of the system, and they're not willing to commit to it being this way for the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So they say, this is private, this is reserved for Apple use, because we might change this. And if we change it and you're using it, things will break. We know where we're using it, so if we change it, we will, hopefully, change our use of it in all of those places such that nothing breaks. And what happened here was a case of effectively APIs being injected into the system through these various means, and then whatever they were calling on the other end wasn't there anymore. But they had gotten so worked into it that they were in the boot process, and that was enough to bring down your system and to bring down APE's reputation.
We don't want to solely trash Haxies and the APE SDK because, like we said, a lot of people did find utility or maybe just, you know, like aesthetic pleasure in them. So there were some Unsanity first-party Haxies that were built and released on the APE platform that we thought were worth discussing on the show as well.
You know, if things hadn't gotten out of hand, these would be more fondly remembered. You know, in the way that we remember and did two episodes on Kaleidoscope, a lot of these are interface changes. And people loved these kind of apps. And there were apps like, you know, like Candy Bar from the Icon Factory that would do these things in a more safe and responsible way.
Yeah.
And the fact that some of these utilities got wrapped up in the whole APE debacle has colored our opinion of them. But they were cool at the time.
The first one I want to talk about is one called Metallifizer. And it was a Haxy to kind of make the use of brushed metal in the OS X interface more consistent, I think. I bet that was the goal, because I think John Gruber has covered this. John Siracusa has covered this in his OS X reviews. I think Stephen Hackett kind of anthropomorphized the brush metal in a series on 512 pixels.
We will link to the brush metal diaries.
The rise and fall of brushed metal's appearance in OS X is well documented, and this was a Haxy to add or subtract it from different parts of the interface, maybe windows or controls, etc. I wanted to discuss this because I never used the APE platform or any of Unsanity or anybody else's Haxies. I did, however, use a very similar program to Metallifizer. I keep having this struggle on that name. Metallifizer, called Uno. And this, I remember this was released, I think, in advance of OS 10.4 Tiger, where the actual brushed metal texture was removed from the interface. And, you know, like screenshots were released before the software was. And people said, like, oh, I want that. It looks so clean.
Oh, I get it. It's a pun on the unified window appearance, Uno.
Exactly. So I definitely downloaded this this Uno app. And a worthwhile distinction between Uno and Haxies is arguable whether it's safer or not, but Uno actually had its own, pattern resources or whatever the system used to draw brushed metal. Uno would actually swap those files out of your install with their own unified patterns or gradients or color definitions. So it would modify your system install the one time, and then, you know, the next time you rebooted, the system would just load those resources instead of brushed metal. And it's a risky operation, to be sure, but it only does it once. And at the time of install, it knows where to do it, so there's no risk of breaking things. So I felt safe running Uno until I got my own copy of Tiger.
Yeah, this was another one of those cases, though, yeah, with adding or subtracting brush metal, where it was a polarizing design choice. And some people were like, oh my gosh, I have to have it everywhere. And it wasn't everywhere yet. And that's more like Uno. And some people were like, oh my gosh, this is the ugliest thing that I've ever seen. Get it off my Mac. And apparently Metallifizer would let you go either way. Another minor interface tweak that was available as a Haxy is called Silk. It says that it offers silky smooth quartz text rendering. Interestingly, this is something that Apple is apparently still struggling with to this very day, is how exactly to render text, especially at small sizes, doing anti-aliasing. If you listen to Accidental Tech podcast, you've probably heard Marco go on long rants about how his LCD font smoothing preference doesn't work the way that he wants it to in High Sierra. And then it was finally explained what he was seeing that nobody else was seeing, and then everybody was ruined.
Myself included, by the way.
Yeah, it can be bad. Font rendering is weird. Like, I was working on a document in Pages the other day, and I had two copies of what were the same text in the same font, and I'm looking back and forth between them going, these are both Lotto regular 11 point. They're both at 150% zoom. They're both solid black. Why does one look slightly different than the other? And the reason was because in one of the files, I had an image that was in the like master template of the file in the to put it at the like far background. And as soon as I copied that image into the new document and moved it into the background, all the text rendering changed and they looked the same.
Oh my God.
Like, come on. So this is ongoing, but people have always wanted their text to look good. And Silk promised that using the advanced features of Quartz, which still stick around. And maybe Marco needs a haxi.
I'm sure he would love to open up his system to Ape.
We'll get to the real downfall of this towards the end, but this is completely impossible now to try to pull something like this in High Sierra. There were a whole bunch of other little haxies that got released in this time. One that brought the functionality of classic labels to early OS X, of course, now long superseded by actual Finder tags. Something called Menu Extra Enabler. Again, menu extras are now fully enabled. Menu Master, which allowed you to set up custom keyboard shortcuts for menu items, now in your keyboard system preference pane. One called Mighty Mouse that was not related to either the Apple hardware or the cartoon character, although in later versions had a definitely close to trademark infringing superhero mouse as its icon. It was just for like cursor customization, so you could make, you know, crazy mouse cursors. There was something called Safari No Time Out that was supposed to address a particular bug in Safari. And then finally, the big one, probably the biggest and most interesting haxi of them all.
Yes, we're talking about Shapeshifter, which the tagline on Unsanity's Shapeshifter page is, change the look of your Mac temporarily and forever, exclamation point.
I really don't know what that means.
Maybe it's like you can revert it if it's breaking your system.
Yeah.
But yeah, Shapeshifter is basically Kaleidoscope for OS X. And Ed also referenced Candy Bar, production by the Icon Factory and Panic earlier. It was full appearance customization of the Mac OS X interface. Certainly the system UI, things like the window chrome, you know, way more than just the metallifier brushed metal options. There were full icon set replacements and also cursors handled within Shapeshifter, though it probably is just reusing the Mighty Mouse Haxi or the Haxi's core code. And I don't think it ever reached the full community strength that Kaleidoscope had with however many Scheme authors and Scheme creators there were. But it definitely had a solid following. There was a site called Mac Themes that not only cataloged a bunch of Shapeshifter themes, but actually reviewed them and kind of assigned scores and promoted certain ones. And this was brought to our attention recently in a tweet from friend of the show, Phil Dokus. So we'll put a link to the Internet Archive's version of Mac Themes. Particularly of note with Mac Themes, one of the people behind it was Phil Ryu. I'm very sorry if I've continued to say this name incorrectly, because this is someone who's big in kind of this era of the Mac community. We covered his work on My Dream App in episode 34 of this show, and he's also one of the people behind The Heist, which was another big Mac and iOS app during this time. And in looking through Mac Themes, I found that a lot of the highlighted ones and the ones that got reviews seemed to follow a theme of trying to emulate other interfaces. There were kind of tweaks to Aqua or being able to revert your 10.3, 10.4 install back to like public beta with very heavy pinstripe Aqua. There were also, of course, there was a shapeshifter theme to make your Mac look like Windows XP. There were a couple themes that tried to make your Mac look like kind of early era PDA with that kind of original Game Boy olive green color.
Or like a very early iPod screen.
Yeah, exactly. And with that green and a lot of grays on top. So like a lot of kind of functional themes and not so much of the wacky experimental kaleidoscope schemes that we discussed in our episode and continue to see on the Kaleidoscope Schemes Twitter account.
Two main things that really prevented there from being just like the sheer number and breadth of schemes that we saw with Kaleidoscope and especially with Kaleidoscope 2 is the fact that with Shapeshifter, it was not as simple to get into scheming. And I mean, even in the Kaleidoscope 2 era, it could be a little bit tricky to define how your windows were supposed to be created. But the basic, you know, the basic crux of it was you could say, hey, I want to tweak a scheme that I already have. Just copy the file, open it up with ResEdit that you already have a free copy of. Go in, say, hey, I want to make the close box look different. Go in there, open up the resource, draw some stuff, close it, save, double-click that new scheme file, and you could see it in action. And that let a lot of people with just like very basic ResEdit knowledge get into it. Whereas with Shapeshifter, creating and bundling up these schemes, or whatever they called them, themes, was a lot more difficult. I don't even were they using PDF resources at this point, like the way that Quartz was composing the windows? I never really got into creating Shapeshifter themes, but I heard that it was a little bit tricky. Some people did try to port their Kaleidoscope schemes over to Shapeshifter. So you might even spot a couple familiar ones on some of the resources and catalogs of themes that we'll link in the show notes. And one of the other things that was limiting was some of the most popular Kaleidoscope 2 schemes couldn't even be ported over to Shapeshifter because one of the limitations was that you couldn't actually change the outline of the window. So you had a certain number of pixels to work within, kind of like it was in the Kaleidoscope 1 days, where you got that platinum window border to work in and no more. That meant that there are some that have some like tiny little tweaks to the window border. Like there's one where there's like a little indent by where the window controls are, but that's just making a few handful of transparent pixels is all that it's doing there. You couldn't build onto the window in any way. You could only subtract. So you would never get, you know, some of the really flamboyant schemes, your boilerplates and your ISA shock, whatever it was called, or those schemes that tried to make drop shadows with dithered masks. Like none of that was possible. So even though it was the most customization that was possible for the overall OS X interface, I think that it left a little bit to be desired, especially for people who really liked the, you know, just the amount of power and creativity that Kaleidoscope had offered previously.
Kind of addressing the difficulty of creating these themes, there was a feature of Shapeshifter added in version 2.2 that Unsanity called GUI tweak, which is camel cased. So that's like the GUI is all lowercase and the T is capital. GUI tweak let the end user of Shapeshifter, who had already found some themes they wanted and installed them on their system, modify the GUI kit files in those themes using core image filters, which basically to me sounds like the kind of late stage Audion feature where you could change the primary color of a skin, even if the developer shipped kind of a translucent olive green skin that made your MP3 player look like a pager. You could go into the Audion preferences and make that green pager a translucent pink. And it sounds like this GUI tweak in Shapeshifter was a similar thing that made its kind of limited selection of themes still more customizable on the basis of the primary color in each theme. I wanted to mention that the company Interacto, which made the Uno system add-on to get rid of brushed metal, also had their own stab at complete macOS X theming called Flavors, and spelled with the U in Flavors. And the website for Flavors is still live. You can go to it. We'll put a link in the show notes. And they talk a little bit about their approach, which makes it sound like Flavors, when it worked, took the approach of Uno in that it straight up modified system resources so that when the system called upon them to draw a window or whatever, it kept pulling from the same new file rather than trying to hijack a process and override how the system drew it every time.
Right. Somewhere deep in the bowels of the system are actual little, I believe, PDF resources that determine the appearance of windows. And it was swapping those out. It was actually, I think it had an option to make a backup copy of everything. I installed that and talked about it briefly on episode 2 or 3 of this very show.
I think so.
And I felt like it was about to break everything, and I very quickly uninstalled it. Again, none of the elegance of something like the Kaleidoscope extension, because to get the system to call upon those newly swapped out resources, and swapped out in sort of the, you know, like Indiana Jones with the bag of sand kind of way, right?
Yeah.
So to do that, you would have to basically, I mean, I guess you would basically just have to start Windows Server over. You might have been able to do like, I don't think even like kill all dash M doc would be enough. And so it was like, okay, I wanted to switch my theme. Okay, restart your Mac. And it's like, oh, that's not a fun experience. And that was part of the thing that concerned me. It's like, oh, I've like changed all this stuff, and then I go to restart, and what happens if I get stuck on the gray screen because something has gone horribly wrong? It really put the fear in me. Of course, Apple went ahead and put the fear in them, because they're very clear about the fact that this only works in Yosemite. And that's because in El Capitan, system integrity protection was included in the operating system for the first time. And that means that the operating system is not going to just go and blindly load in whatever file is at a particular path down in the system folder, because who knows what you put in there to cause some, you know, buffer overrun and take control of the entire system. It's going to go in there and go, this is a very beautiful file, but the checksum does not match and I will not run it.
I particularly love this line from their FAQ that basically discusses this, the state of their theming application, and by extension, all theming applications on the Mac, is that they won't work as of El Capitan and the system integrity protection. This line says, the new security policy prevents every process, even privileged ones, from modifying system files, either on file system or dynamically at runtime. Feels like it's a little subtle jab at the Ape SDK.
Yeah, it's a shame that these are you know, really and truly dead. I mean, when we recorded episode 2, they weren't really and truly dead. But now they are. And, you know, some of these are, you know, really classy and look good. And it would be nice if there were some ways to do some really tasteful customization of the operating system, both on the Mac and on iOS.
So that kind of is the end of the line, not just for Flavors, not just for Shapeshifter, but we really haven't seen anything in the way of Haxis or the Ape SDK since around that time.
I guess the one thing to wrap up then is that, yeah, we've declared that the era of the Haxi is over. Well, really, Apple has declared that they were not keen on them even when they were popular, and now they are truly impossible. But the thing that is still kind of an outstanding question is, well, whatever happened to Unsanity then? Because they were the Haxi company.
There's a thread on Ars Technica that asks this question, what happened to Unsanity? And, you know, there's a little bit of discussion. One of the points being that this co-founder we've discussed in this episode, Slava Karpenko, is active on Twitter, is actively working for a software development company, and retains, I think, domain registrations in his name that point back to Unsanity and some of the Haxies and Shapeshifter. But other than that, it seems like any software, any new Haxies, anything coming out from the Unsanity name will not happen.
Yeah, they've just kind of let it run its natural course and fade away.
Neither of us were very big on Haxies or the Ape SDK.
Well, I think by the time that I really knew what was going on, I was a little bit scared. And I didn't mention this earlier when we talked about it, Window Shade. I really wanted Window Shade back in OS X, but I was a high schooler and I was too cheap to pay $7 shareware to get it back. So I just got used to minimizing Windows.
Kind of saved you from yourself.
Yeah, I think so. I think I really would have gone down the Haxie road if I had shelled out those $7.
So if any of you listeners have screenshots or stories from this era, we would love to see them.
Yeah, I mean, especially because, you know, it was easy enough to go through and see the first party Unsanity Haxies nicely preserved by the Wayback Machine. And of course, we'll link to those in the show notes. But there was this whole world of them out there. So if there are any that we missed that you fondly remember, please send us any information that you have. You can always send us a message, especially if it's longer, through our website at simplebeep.com. There's a contact form there. Or I guess you can send us longer messages now on Twitter, too, up to 280. And you can find the show there at simple_beep.
We're also individually on Twitter. I'm at bsuto, B-S-U-T-O.
And I'm at ecormony. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.